This is a UC San Diego Blinkcast.
It's my pleasure today to introduce Dr. Daniel Lee, who's an assistant clinical professor and the director of podiatric surgery from the Department of Orthopedic Surgery at UC San Diego. Please welcome Dr. Lee.
Thank you. Thank you. Good afternoon, or good morning, passing to good afternoon. It's my pleasure to talk to you and share with you some ideas and some of the nuances in the foot and ankle arena. This is my specialty. This is what I do every day, day in and day out. And hopefully I'll be able to share with you some of the new things that you may have heard or may not have heard. It's quite difficult sometimes to fit everything into, I guess, an hour talk, lecture. So I picked some of these topics that might be of interest to you, to your family, neighbors, or whoever. And then after that, we can open up the floor if you have some questions about other things. But I wanted to go over some key things, maybe some new things in the horizon. As you know, I belong to the School of Medicine, and we have been doing a lot of cutting-edge studies in many different areas. And these areas are the ones that I like to share with you and update you about them. Some of the goals will be, first, to give you, no pun intended, a crash course in foot and ankle anatomy. All right, if this was the anatomy course, which I just taught last month, we'll be spending several hours, but we don't have that time. So I'll try to go over that as briefly as possible. Raise your hand if you have any questions, and we can address those. We'll go over some common conditions. I won't be able to go over all of them, but some of the main ones that might catch your attention, or perhaps ones that we can perhaps take a tangent later on and ask a side question related to it. An update on new technology. As you know, we work very closely with new technologies and new biotech. And as you know, we're in this area in San Diego where that's highly proliferated. And I can share with you some of the new things that we've been able to utilize from the bench science to the clinical practice. And some in shoes. I get this question all the time. Now it's a bullet. That's going to have its own separate talk about shoes. And that leads into prevention. And hopefully that will catch your attention as well so that you could avoid the common conditions that I will be disclosing to you earlier. All right, the foot and ankle. It's a very interesting part of the body. It's an extremity. It's part of the lower extremity of the body. It consists of several joints. Some of the main ones that you want to know are the ankle joint, subtalar joint, talonavicular joint, and the first metatarsal phalangeal joint. If I were to point to them, the ankle joint will be here. All right, this is where you move your ankle up and down. The subtalar joint, there's actually a joint underneath the ankle, which moves the heel bone. The joint in front of it is your talonavicular joint. It assists in cushioning your foot and also holding up your arch. And then as you come off the toe, as you push off, and in your gait cycle, as you walk, then the joint attached to your big toe is your first metatarsal phalangeal joint. All these joints move in different planes. To make it easy, we have split the planes into three: sagittal plane, coronal plane, and transverse plane. This is one way to identify in 3D where each joint is located. So each plane has its name, and therefore we're able to measure the range of motion, how much muscle strength each of these joints have. And this is universal. This can be applied to the hip, knees, upper extremity, and so forth. Let's go down the joints. The ankle joint is a modified hinge joint. It's mostly in the sagittal plane, meaning it's up and down, very minimal on the other plane. As you can see, you won't be able to move the ankle too much in or too much out. It's mostly up and down. The ligaments attached to them can be pictured like this. As you can see, there are ligaments which attach from bone to bone, allowing the bone to stay within the socket or to stay attached to the next bone. The next joint down the row is going to be the subtalar joint. It consists of the anterior, middle, and posterior facets. These facets are the cartilage lining that covers the bone that allows the bone to move smoothly. Now, the motion is mainly on the frontal plane. It's stabilized by ligaments connecting two bones together, namely the talus and the calcaneus. The mid-tarsal joint is the joint down the line, consisting of two parts, talonavicular joint and calcaneo-cuboid joint. They play a role in keeping the foot mobile, at the same time allowing the arch to spring and to keep an architecture around your foot, and I'll talk more about that as we go on. As we go down towards the toes, there are long, slender bones called metatarsals. These bones are five, and these are the shapes and the structures from each view, and they hold the toe together and their extension of them, and they are tightly together on the bases by ligaments. As we go further, we'll have the interphalangeal joints, and these are the joints down the toes, 1 through 5, and main motion is in the sagittal plane, consisting of up and down. It's very difficult to move the toes in and out like we can do it in the hands, as we can cross our fingers, but it's quite difficult to do so on the toes, so the movements are somewhat restricted in that sense. Now, how does that all work in concert? There are theories and there are multiple principles that we believe in that work to put all these bones together. This is sort of a cartoonish picture as to how the lower extremities work. So if you start from the foot, you see this dotted line and this straight line. These are called vectors. These vectors dictate where your leg is going to move. Most experts agree that both lower extremities work like a pendulum. So it'll be two pendulums going back and forth. That has a momentum, that has a motion, that has a range of motion, and they need to be somewhat equal to have proper balance. The arch, as it is depicted in these pictures, can show you how you can increase your arch as the toe goes up by the soft tissue structures attached to the bottom of the foot. So everything is connected from the toes all the way up to your spine, and they can play consequences whether you have injuries, pathologies, conditions, arthritis, deformities, and so forth. All these have been measured. I don't want to bore you with these numbers, but these are the numbers that we live and die by, and we want to keep all our patients as close to these numbers as possible. Every time we have any deformities or injuries, these are the numbers that we look for to try to bring our patients back to that normal condition. These lines can be traced all the way down from the hip, all the way down to the ankle. More lines, as you can see, these lines need to be matching as we follow them all the way down to the floor, which is down here. The heel bone is the calcaneus, and the long bone here is your tibia. They have lines, and it's almost like geometry. These lines have angles. These lines move in certain directions. And by taking x-rays, if you ever go to see your orthopedist or your foot and ankle surgeon, you'll get x-rays. These x-rays are not just looked at for breakage, arthritis, but also alignment. We want to see where the alignment is. And these are some of the alignments that we like to look at to see where have you deviated, where have you gone from one line to the other. Now, as far as the foot, we believe in something called column theory. The foot works, even though there's 26 bones, they work in regions, almost like East Coast, West Coast, Midwest, the South. They have a little region, and they all work in a similar fashion. They've been named as medial, lateral, posterior columns. They work like a tripod. As you can see, there are three parts. A tripod is very stable. If you only have two parts, you won't be able to stand very nicely. Our goal in many of our surgeries and many of the problems we have is to achieve a foot that will give us a stable tripod. Now that we know there's three regions, those three regions have to work in concert to create that tripod. Now, every time you have a tripod, you have axes. So you have joints that will move in certain direction. So we group them up in anatomical groups, like the ankle, subtalar joint, metatarsal joint, the ones that we went over early on in the anatomy section. they work in concert, in groups. This is very important for us. This is very important in the surgical treatment and also in the non-surgical treatment of the foot and ankle. More pictures. This is the axis for the ankle. Your ankle most commonly will move around this black line. Okay? So that'll be your hinge. So the ankle will rotate along those lines. Now, if you follow them from different views, you can see how the line has been calculated, has 20 to 30 degrees external rotation, meaning it's pointing towards the outside, and from top to bottom, about 9 degrees. You can see that if you have an ankle that's tilted, these angles can be measured to see how much the ankle has deviated from normal. So if you were to be at 90 degrees here, you're at 105 in this particular picture. If you needed to be at 90, now you're at 60. Now those angles can give us details as to what position and alignment your lower extremity is. This can be viewed in different pictures as well. When you have x-rays, you won't just get one x-ray. You'll probably get two or three x-rays to see the three-dimensional shape on an x-ray that's only two-dimension. So taking multiple views allows us to see it in multiple planes. So this will tell us if the ankle is slipping forward, slipping backwards, and also measure the angle to see how the ankle is functioning. More pictures for you, and these are the subtalar joint axes, which is at 42 degrees to the ground on this view, and it's about 12 degrees on this view. As we go down to the foot, the mid-tarsal joint has further angles, and they are called the oblique and the longitudinal mid-tarsal joint axes, and they cross each other, and their purpose is to hold your arch as well. Finally, we have two more angles, mainly for the great toe or the first ray, which is this guy right here, and for the fifth ray, which is this one right here. They're each deviated from the regular plane by 45 degrees and this one by 35 degrees. How does this play a role in deformity and problems? Arthritis is a very common condition. How many of you have or know somebody who have arthritis? Okay. The definition of arthritis in a simplest term is a disorder of joints characterized by deterioration of articular cartilage. So the cartilage is being damaged. The cartilage is wearing out. As you know, we are all biologic beings, and these materials, these tissues won't last forever. There are certainly risk factors that makes it worse. And you can divide them in pretty much two areas. Non-modifiable, meaning you just can't change them. And the modifiable ones, these are the ones that we can work on. And you'll hear the doctor talk about it. Age, if you know how to change age, let me know. I've been losing hair for the last 10 years. It's not fun. Gender, genetics, all right? You know the story about the apple in the tree? All right, that plays a role. Modifiables. These are the factors that you could actually change. Your weight, any injuries, chances for infection, job, weather, the medication, supplement. These are the things that you can modify, change, take or not take, do or not do at your will that will allow you to get some benefits from it. How about some data? Based on the National Health Interview Survey, 1 out of 5, so about 21% adults in the U.S., report having doctor-diagnosed arthritis. The latest numbers, 50% of adults greater than 65 report an arthritis diagnosis. By 2030, an estimated 67 million Americans age 18 and older are projected to have a doctor-diagnosed arthritic condition. An estimated close to 300,000 children less than 18 will have some form of arthritic condition. That's 1 out of 250 children. And these numbers are old. These numbers keep creeping up. More statistics from the CDC. Arthritis is the most common cause of disability in the United States. 19 million adults say arthritis limits their usual activity in some way. 8.2 million working age U.S. adults, 1 in 20, report work limitations due to arthritis or joint symptoms. How about the cost? What is this costing us in healthcare? Based on the 2003 report from the CDC, it's about $128 billion. Yes, billion $1,000 for this arthritic condition. And this is just arthritis. We're not talking about some of the other diseases like hypertension, cancer, diabetes. Medical expenditure has been rising. You can see that there's earning losses, so this affects our countries and our society's productivity. How about the other factors like mental and emotional health? This has been strongly associated due to the limitation of it. And joint replacements, obviously you can see that are rising. And these are numbers only for the knee. So as far as 2003, there were 418,000 knee replacements. And this is in the US alone. And these are figures from 2003. And these numbers are rising more and more. So I'm just trying to make a point that arthritis is a problem. It's a concern. It's out there. And the numbers can show you why. So the problem has been for the doctors, the dilemma with the joint. What do we do with the arthritic joint? And that question for us that has been bothering us for ages and ages has been, do you fuse or not to fuse? What do you do? And obviously there's pros and cons for each, and maybe I can help you to demystify this a little bit. Ankle arthritis. Currently, believe it or not, the gold standard is fusion. So if you have an arthritic ankle, the gold standard everywhere will be to fuse. However, there have been studies and reports of other alternatives to fusion. Obviously, fusion is not fun. It will give you some limitation to your motion. So thus, multiple other attempts and treatments have been performed. However, the question has been, which one do you do? We don't know. Maybe I can demystify some of it by giving you some information. So let's do a literature search. What does the literature say? So I looked all over the literature to see what other information can we gather from ankle arthritis. Let's see. As far as 1985, looking at in view of high complication rate and generally poor long-term clinical results, we recommend arthrodesis, which is the word for fusion, as a treatment of choice for painful, stiff, arthritic ankle, regardless of the pathological process. So these ankle implants, they look like metal in there. They're not working well. So as far as 85, we're not recommending it. All right, let's keep moving forward. 1996, what have we said? We no longer recommend ankle implant for the rheumatoid or osteoarthritis of the ankle. That sounds almost the same as 85. So we spent almost 10 to 11 years of research, clinical trials, and this is what we end up so far. All right, let's keep moving along. 2000, what are the reports? Disappointing, no workable design, meaning the design of the implant, you can't work with it. Lack of published data, we don't have good results as far as our clinical information. And look at patient satisfaction. I'd rather be in this area. But look at the discrepancy as far as range. I don't think this is a very good number. If I'm satisfied 20%. So, what's a fusion? If this were to be a normal ankle, the ankle is composed of several joint spaces. You have the bone right here consisting of talus, mostly known as the ankle bone. You have this long leg bone called tibia, and next to it you have its companion, fibula, holding onto the ankle, and you can see almost this inverted U shape. That's the joint space. That's where the cartilage of the ankle is lining. If that was to be the normal one, fusion is this. Obviously, it doesn't have all the metal that allowed the fusion, but now you don't see any of the space that you can see up there. That's a fusion. That's when the bone is bone on bone together, fused, non-mobile, frozen in that one position forever and ever and ever. What's an implant? Well, the attempt for the implant is to keep the motion alive. And by doing so, you apply screws, plates, and this metal device to keep the motion, just like in the hips and the knees. But what has the literature said? And let's go down as far as 2007. 49 studies qualify for this review. From 1990 to 2005, they looked at ankle fusions and ankle implants. Which one is going to be more favorable? Well, let's look at the results. People who said excellent on the implant, 38%. Fusion, 31%. Good, 30, 37, fair, 5, 13, poor, 24, 13. Do you see a pattern? Any difference along those numbers? Nothing really standing out, correct? Let's look at the revision, meaning a reduce. Well, implant 7%, fusion 9%. That's not very different either. The conclusion by these authors were that implant appears to be similar to the ankle fusion. And the logical question is, then what? Why do we have to go through all that to go and have an ankle implant and not a fusion? So which one is better? We don't know. So since then, we had this huge evolution of biologic technology. Let's keep everything natural. That's one of the mottos. Let's try to revive the cartilage. Let's try to keep what we've got. Since the metal implant is not working and the fusion is not the greatest of an option, what can we do? What's in the horizon as far as biologic treatment? Well, as you know, biologic implants have been used in a lot of general surgery and plastic surgery for many, many functions. And utilizing these methods, we're able to see if we can preserve the damaged cartilage that we already have in the ankle. The current methods that we have is to utilize certain pins around the ankle area in a temporary fashion. It might look a little gruesome to you or prehistoric. These pins are outside the ankle, keeping the ankle apart so that the damaged cartilage has time to live, or it has some time to regenerate, hopefully. What does it do? Well, the effects will be to promote self-repair, healing of the cartilage, decreases the pressure on the cartilage so you're not impacting it, bone on bone. Positive effects on nerve endings, decreases the inflammation and promotes scar tissue formation in between, almost like a cushion effect to the area. The advantages are that you remove no bone, meaning you keep the anatomy intact. So it's not like a fusion nor like an implant. The disadvantages are that you'll have some temporary pins that you'll have to deal with, and then they have to be removed. What am I talking about? These pins work as follows. If this were a model of the ankle, and you can see that I showed you where the ankle looks like, you can see that bone on bone, correct? That's stuck together. Now we apply this device and see what happens. We're able to empty that space and increase it by lengthening it and giving it space, space that you didn't have, the space that has been shrinking as arthritic conditions have been advancing. So this current method involves in putting that biologic implant that I was telling you about into the damaged cartilage, as you can see on top, as a layer that's in my hands. We layer it in the front of the ankle. We make a small incision in the front and put those pins in place. What are some of the results? Well, no names mentioned, 69-year-old woman with osteoarthritis of the ankle. Now, do you see any joint space? Correct. No joint space in this area. Now, do you see a joint space in that area? And that's afterwards. And look at the motion that the patient is able to have from that. Now, this is keeping all the anatomy intact. We're not putting any metal in there like the traditional way. This is also applicable for younger patients. Imagine if you are a 37-year-old who needs an ankle fusion. According to the US data, we as Americans are expected to live, what, 72, 75? That's our average life expectancy these days. Well, if you're fusing your ankle at 37, you have many years to live with the fused ankle. That's going to cause problems. So this is another good alternative for this particular patient. Open, distract, and keep that open, and keep the ankle mobile. And as you can see, no metal, nothing to interfere with the normal anatomy. We're trying to work with what you have by feeding it into the ankle joint and providing more life to it with the hopes that this will restore some motion and perhaps at the least buy you more time until our implant technology can improve like the hip and the knees. So some of our results were published, and this is from my publication. And thus far, we have had no patient that went into a fusion, nor who requested a metal implant. So far, so good. Arthritis can occur in the foot, in the ankle, in the toes, can lead to deformity, and usually leads to pain and swelling. Arthritis is also bunion. Bunion is also arthritis. Bunions are deformities in the forefoot area, in the joint called first metatarsophalangeal joint. And I see a lot of patients with bunion deformities, and this is a typical picture of a bunion, and that's bone malaligned within that joint. What can we do for that? Well, there are a couple of options. We can also straighten them out, or we can put an implant. Now, you can see how the bone is sticking out this way, and this looks a little worse on this side. These are two different bunion types, each having different treatment options. If we catch these bunions early enough, we can straighten them out like this with a small pin, as you can see, and the bone will be straighter than the previous picture. Now, if we see a patient at this stage, this salvage procedure can be more difficult. Then we have an implant that can be applied. Can you see those two metal implants? And you can see a better and straighter foot. Corrections can also be obtained to the fifth toe or to the fifth metatarsal. These are called bunionette. So the bunion will be for the big toe and bunionette for the small toe. Now, it's also called tailor's bunion because it used to occur in a lot in tailors. And you can put a small pin, correct the bunion, or shape the bone on the bunionette. Arthritis can also occur on the big toe, where you could have arthritis in that joint between the two tiny bones at the great toe. And we put pins and screws in a temporary basis to unite and correct those bones. Now, you can see hammer toe deformities as well, where you can have a crossover of that toe. This toe will not go back manually. So non-surgical options are not very successful for that. And you can see with surgery that the toes can be realigned, put back in the better position. Now, what can we say about visits and foot and ankle conditions? In 2001, based on the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons, 14.2 million visits were made to physician offices due to foot and ankle problems. Out of those, 2.3 million visits from sprains and other ankle injuries. As we walk, some of the statistics is that 1.5 of your body weight goes in your foot. So if you are 50 pounds, about 100, 75, your extremity can be allowed to cushion your foot. This cushioning effect occurs in all the joints that I mentioned early on in the anatomy, and this has to do with how many steps you take. As shock absorbers, your feet will cushion up to 1 million pounds of pressure. So every day you walk, and as long as there's gravity on Earth, that will play a role, and that will be a truism. This has increasingly worsened our foot and ankle visits, mainly because of something called aerobic exercise and dancing, a big fad. And when I looked it up, it's about in the 60s when it started growing in popularity, and it really boomed in the 80s, a little up and downs on the 80s, but it's a very popular condition. They think over 24 million people participate in some type of aerobic exercise on a daily basis. It might be good for the body, but for joints that have arthritis, it's probably not a good idea. Why? Well, it has to do with some of the things that you may have learned in preschool, kindergarten. Newton's third law. What is Newton's third law? Do we have any teachers in the room? I'm going to have to ask Gary then. I'm joking, Gary. Absolutely. So for every reaction, there's an equal and opposite reaction. That's how the arches work. Your arches are almost like a springboard effect. The more resistance you have from the bottom, you have to have an equal opposing from the other side. And believe it or not, we can win against the ground, especially if it's a concrete floor. We will always, always lose, or your arch will always lose to the concrete ground floor. So therefore, if your arches are hurting, keep in mind Newton's third law. the ground was stronger than your feet or your arches, so has given up. How does that work? Well, the Romans got this right. They started building these bridges with multiple arches to hold the structure, trying to get a balance between load and support, and you find an equilibrium. And with that, they found that arches along bridges are successful, as I try to put a picture up there. Ligament injuries are quite common as well. Ankle sprains. The incident has been anywhere from 1 out of 10,000 of the population per day, and multiple conditions can arise from it. Why do I talk about ankle sprain? Believe it or not, ankle sprain in our practice currently is the leading cause of early stage ankle arthritis. As your ankle twists, you'll see that the structure of the ankle bone is as follows. This is your talus, which is a little wider in the front, a little narrow on the bottom. And this is the bone that holds your ankle in place and is within your ankle. This will is connected to multiple ligaments and will allow the ankle move in certain positions, and it plays a role as to getting any arthritis. Now, this part that you see on top is called Taylor dome. That's the dome that allows the ankle to move up and down. Any dent, any injury to that nicely smooth glistening cartilage will lead to arthritis. The ligaments of the ankle, and this is not Mickey Mouse, but it ended up being like that, holds three ligaments, and they are anterior talofibular ligament, calcaneofibular ligament, and posterior talofibular ligament. These three ligaments hold the ankle on the outside, and they're most commonly involved in ankle sprains. When we look at the anatomy to it, we notice that the ligaments have a different breadth and number to it. Some of them have a single ligament, some of them have bifurcate, meaning two, and some of them have trifurcate, meaning three different branches. This has given us clues as to you can tear one of them, and the ankle will still be intact. You can still have pain, you can still have a tear, but the ankle won't come out of the socket, perhaps. It will hold it because of the multiple bands available. The most commonly, the two band, the bifurcate. Clinical tests have been performed. However, the most important thing is the history, how you did it, what position was your ankle. Those are the main things you want to describe to your doctor and tell them in what position did your ankle twist. That information is crucial for us because it will tell us as to which ligament probably was compromised. And then that in turn will lead into what treatments you can have for those ligaments. You can have instability that can be divided into functional or mechanical. You can also have impingement, meaning there will be a soft tissue or bone fragments caught inside the ankle, not allowing the ankle move in the normal motion like we described earlier, which is sagittal plane, moving the ankle up and down. If you have any of these impingements, it won't allow you to move the ankle properly. We do tests to assess for them. One of them is called the antral drawer test, as the picture shows, to see if the ankle will be softer or stiffer as we move the ankle forward. We also do a test called Taylor tilt test. It allows us to tilt the ankle in the opposite direction. It's about 90 degrees away from the other test, and see which ligament is giving you problems, which one is giving you pain or not. That gives us hints. It's not a fail-proof test, but gives us hint as to which ligaments are in or which ligaments are out. And to be complete, this is a list of possible differential diagnosis. Other things besides an ankle sprain that you may have. You can have an occult fracture, lesions, loose bodies. You can have fracture, a stress fracture, capsular injuries that can come with just an ankle sprain. So most of the times, ankle sprain can be just an umbrella term. But within it, there are multiple specific diagnoses under them where you can either have a ligament injury, cartilage injury, bone injury, and so forth. We do take images to figure out what exactly has happened to them. The most accurate has been the MRI. The MRI has given us close to 100% predictive value as to what's going on with the ankle. Based on that, we can grade it. We can say grade 1, 2, and 3. 1 obviously being mild, grade 2 being the moderate, and grade 3 being severe. Usually, grade 1 is your most typical ankle sprain. A week or two, you're doing fine. If you're not doing fine, consider that you may have grade 2. Grade 2, you see some partial tear. The swelling won't go away. Then it's more than just a minor partial tear to the area. Grade 3 is the most severe one, where you have a complete rupture of those ligaments. And some people are different. I've had multiple patients who had complete tears, but their pain threshold is so high, they don't perceive it as a complete tear. And they're just walking around with a complete tear and will be unrecognized for many, many months until somebody will tell them, you know what, all your ligaments are gone. They're no longer there. So just because you're walking on it, and it's sort of one of those myths, oh, if you can stand on it, if you can walk on it, you're fine. Not so true. Somehow, I don't know when, we developed to have this pain threshold. We'll keep on trucking and withstand it. And as you know, you may have family members or friends who have a pain threshold that's so high. You may have heard stories of someone having a fracture, an injury, they didn't even know it, until images, MRI, CT scans, an exam, or they finally went to the ER, finally went to the doctor and found out what they had. We really don't do much for the grade ones and twos. These are the ones that get better. They rarely need surgery, usually physical therapy, immobilizing it, having a special boot. Those things do help. And grade three is the one that is more controversial. These are the patients that will require surgery. There will be some kind of type of discussion as to how to fix those ligaments, either borrowing tendons, borrowing other ligaments, using grafts, using your own tissue to repair those ligaments to the area. Like I said, ankle sprains can lead to arthritis, correct? Sometimes, or most of the times, you'll be having an ankle x-ray to make sure you rule out any bone injuries. So as you can see here, at a first glance, you may not suspect of anything. You'll say the ankle is intact, I don't see any breaks, that ankle joint space looks pretty intact, I don't see any fractures to the area. And most of the times, the patient will go home, nurse the ankle for several weeks, and be fine. However, having said that, now that we have access to MRI, we can see something else. Now, you can appreciate this is the same view as that. The long bone here, tibia, talus here, the heel bone there. What is this small thing right there? That's actually almost like a hole inside the cartilage. So you can be represented right here, and you can represent it right there. So as the ankle tilted with the sprain, hit the cartilage to the area, causing a dent. Almost as you were to have a dent in your brand new car, that dent will not get better. Obviously, you can take your car to the shop and fix that dent, but you can't do that with the cartilage. So there are treatment options for them, and lately we've been able to use cadaveric cartilage, taking a piece of the cadaveric tissue and plug it in. So the area that was damaged, the area that had a hole, a dent, can be removed safely, and a new piece of cartilage placed in there. So as you can see, now you have an even surface area to that site. Another topic that I'd like to talk to you about was several years ago, I was fortunate to be at the International Diabetes Federation in Thailand. And on that day, when I was giving a talk, the front page news was this: foot amputated every 30 seconds. This is part of a dear topic of mine because what I like to do is save feet. And one of the main conditions that causes is diabetes. Now, we talked about arthritis. We talked about ankle implants, fusions, common things like an ankle sprain leading to arthritis. This is a different topic. This is what happens to patients who have diabetes. What does diabetes have to do with foot? Well, in Thailand, they try really hard. They try not to have people smoke, and this is completely legal. This probably will never happen in the States. We had to get these pictures and take them. They actually put these pictures on their cigarettes so they stop smoking, so they won't lose their legs because of gangrene and things like that. Believe it or not, they still sell them and people carry this in their pockets. A normal foot will be something like this with an arch, with the heel pointing straight down and being able to go up on your toes. Many of these angles are quite common to us, and we measure them to see to make sure they're in the proper alignment. As I shown you earlier on the cartoon pictures where we draw the lines, we would draw these lines something like this on normal x-rays. An abnormal foot will be something like this, where the line is off, the heel is on the side, the arch is collapsed, and if you look at x-rays, you can see that the lines don't match. These two are supposed to be parallel. You can see the foot is turning the other way. There's a bone breakage there. None of these lines are matching. So what do we do for some of these? A lot of diabetic feet go through a problem called Charcot. Not every diabetic patient has Charcot. Charcot is a French word. It's from the turn of the century. It's when the joint breaks down in the foot. It's most commonly seen in the foot. Diabetes is a leading cause of non-traumatic foot amputations in the U.S. Non-traumatic foot amputations in the U.S. A lot of these conditions we try to salvage, and we go through reconstructive procedures. Everything starts from a blister, ulcer, injury, a small fracture, a small break. In a normal scenario, you'll be fine. In a diabetic scenario, you will not be fine. You will not heal well. If you do heal, it will take a long time. And on top of that, if you're smoking, if you have any other health conditions, that only adds to the problem. So what do we do for some of these things? This patient came to me 2004 with this ulcer on the bottom of the foot. Wasn't able to walk. Every time she walks, the ulcer gets bigger, as you can imagine. A lot of the places, especially in Thailand, they will amputate this leg. They won't have salvage techniques to save this. For them, it's easier to do that, which is why you see on that newspaper every 30 seconds, that foot is amputated. We have other modalities that we can do. We call it skin flap. It's almost like a plastic surgery to clean up the area, rotate them, close it, and this is postoperatively, and this is finally the foot. And these microvascular plastic techniques are useful in salvaging the foot and covering and cleaning that up. Another condition can be patients with diabetes or commonly have ulcers, especially on the bottom of the foot. And this is slightly larger, closer to the midfoot than the other one. The other one was a little closer to the toes. We repair them. Again, a skin plasty, close it up, put some pins to hold it together. So you can see from before, 3 months later, 6 months later. And then this is another successful story that we're able to salvage this foot and not have this foot amputated because of that ulcer. Shoes. This will be my last track. Not all my patients come like this, but somebody so kind sent me this picture file. If you have it, share it with your friends. And these are the latest fashions in shoes. I'm not promoting it nor recommending it, but I'm just sharing with you to say this is a no-no. As you can see, this would probably hurt even just by looking at it. But people still do them. I've seen multiple modifications of shoes, airing out the shoes, making a cutout in the front. I see some patients with this spring-loaded shoes. They seem to like it initially, and then lately I've been seeing people not using them. This person believes in no springs in the shoes. I've seen multiple orthotics, which are specialized arch supports to hold the foot. And somebody did numbers to see how many orthotic types there are. About 5 million. So you have to find the prescription that fits your foot. Not all the orthotics are built the same way. So they have to be customized, unless you get very lucky and find the one that happens to fit you. Some of them are over-the-counter. Some of them are you mold it yourself and turn it into the lab type of orthotics. Some come with a brace. Some don't come with a brace. Some come with a strap. Some don't come with a strap. Even some of these are custom or non-custom. Shoes, as you can see, can have multiple different shapes. This is an x-ray through a high heel. You can see how much pressure you can have on that bone. but my female patients still love them. I can't get them off of them. Shoe design comes in many, many factors, and I'll try to give you at the end my pearls as to how to be wise shoe shoppers as a preventative measure of everything that I've spoken earlier. Shoe industry, as far as 2008, is a $20 billion industry in the US. Huge. And considering that in some countries around the world, they still cannot afford shoes. Okay, this is where we are in the US. The top five companies are pretty much the top go-getters as far as shoe making and shoe industry. The athletic shoe companies categorize shoes in certain ways: athletic, outdoor, and dress, dressy type. People have looked at different ways to purchase shoes. Some of the negative aspects have been the following, and you've probably seen this and heard about them. The wish list has been compiled, and they wanted something that's waterproof, has ventilation, temperature control. You want no maintenance. The shoe has to last forever and ever. No revamping. Very tough request. And people are willing to pay over 25% more if those criteria have been met. So they looked at the advertisement to see what's really what as far as advertisement. And keep in mind, advertisement may not be closely related to health and to medical science. The claims have been anywhere from 11 to 43% in all the categories. It gives you support. It gives you performance, has shock absorption, and 11% for fashion. If you look at comfort, it's been equated by several ways: cushion plus dryness. And I try to put all this in normal terms to see what actually these words mean. When we say performance, the company actually means has shock absorption, it rebounds better, and has optimal foot support. How to improve cushioning, they add pockets or gels to the area. Style has to do with gimmick, endorsement. The value is the ratio between the benefits to the price and the ventilation, how many holes you can make in a shoe. These are different catchy phrases that you'll see in ads, but the truth is we don't see any medical value in any of them. Blisters can occur if you wear wrong shoes. As soon as you increase the body weight, especially in running athletes, it can be over 3 times your body weight. You can have friction, and enough friction will cause blisters. Let's pretend, in a case scenario, you're a diabetic. You have blisters. Then you saw some of the nice pictures I was able to share with you. What would happen if you're a diabetic and have blisters? I've already heard stories from the recent walk that was a few weeks ago, and we already had enough patients with several foot conditions. So abnormal pressure and shear would cause blisters. The fitting is a funny history, and just to be complete, this is a machine that you may not be familiar with. Have you seen this one before? It's an X-ray machine from the turn of the century, from the invention of X-ray. So, as you know, X-ray is not a good thing to be exposed to. You're leaded, you're protected, you're shielded from X-ray rays. We didn't know that in the turn of the century. X-ray was the newest gimmick thing, just like some of the newest gimmick things that you may find these days in the ads. You can go to a shoe store, put your foot inside this hole, you'll have the mom, the child, and perhaps the shoe person, salesman, looking over, and you'll shoot an X-ray. Now, remind you, there is no lead apron. This material is made out of wood, and if you don't know, X-rays go through wood, okay? And keep in mind that the dose for this X-ray was 10 times of a chest X-ray. And this was where everything started. Now, to make it worse, let's say you don't fit in the size 9. Then you bring a size 10 and reshoot. And you'll be going through, let's say you don't like the size 10 in red and you want the size 10 in black, wear and reshoot. And that went over and over and over. History. The fitting of the shoes had been commonly measured by this Brennick device, which was invented in 1927. However, the accuracy has been reported anywhere to 15 to 85%. So just because you're measuring the Brennick device doesn't mean that your accurate shoe size has been met. So it has very minimal value to it. The most important thing has been to measure it, usually at the end of the day, usually with the socks that you'll be wearing the shoes with, and with and without the orthotics that you'll be putting inside the shoe. So there are several factors, and people will vary depending on those conditions. Finally, socks. It's a component in the shoe. It's an important part of the shoe. Believe it or not, perspiration output is greater than 1 pint per foot per day. So your socks and the shoes play a great role in getting this water out. This is called the wicking effect. Otherwise, you'll be in a pretty wet situation, and it probably won't be a very good for you, meaning it can cause blisters, not only that, injuries, not only that, slippage, not only that, fractures, ankle sprains. Ankle sprains can lead to arthritis, and arthritis can lead to joint replacement, fusion. So I'm trying to connect all these dots together for you. Now, socks is a very interesting history, and I'm a big proponent for history, and we can go back as far as 1980s. That's the earliest time we can find any medical articles on the value of socks, and it's fascinating. Since then, the U.S. military has been the best source of socks research, because they can keep a population of patients not going anywhere. There's lots of them, and you can put them in any types of socks and see what works best. Some of the sock studies have been done in diabetic patients to see if the patients will have better support, especially in the peak pressure, meaning less pressure in the bottom of the foot. And it's having specialized socks for diabetics have been quite successful. And this is actually the only study available that you can find that dates back to this time. So the market for socks is $250 million a year. This is socks alone. You can find them in many, many different types. The most important thing is to know that you need to pick the correct socks that will match the correct sport and that will match what the activity you're going to be doing. Some of these fibers, like I mentioned, has a wicking gradient. That has to do with the terminology, hydrophilic and hydrophobic. Hydrophilic, the fibers that absorb moisture. Hydrophobic is the fibers that repel moisture. And each sock has a gradient. So far, we don't have those mandates from companies to put those out on the labels, but I believe that pretty soon we will. They come in multiple conditions: cotton, wool, acrylic, Coolmax, and polypropylene. Last thing will be the orthotics. And these are some pictures of different orthotics, and you can see they come in different shapes and forms. What do you think this orthotic is for? A little interesting shape. This is the heel, this is the toe area. It's one of the newest designs for high heel wearer orthotics. They can be made out of rubber, plastazode, which is a special material. The insoles come in very flexible, which will give you a little spring effect in your arch. They can be semi-rigid and the very rigid ones. So therefore, because there are over 5 million types, make sure you find the prescription that fits you. I hear from many, many patients that the orthotics don't work for me, they hurt me, and so forth. It's probably because you haven't found the right prescription. There's so many different types of orthotics. Shoe gimmicks. They make battery life that lasts 100 hours, that measure your shoes, how many steps you take, calculates it. There's a shoe that you can put an iPod. Very, very interesting. I see them all the time. Shoes have all these different components in the anatomy, what to do. But the main thing is to know that shoes will come mainly in two forms, a straight last and a curved last. So you must find which type of foot you have. Is your foot turning in this way, or is it more a straighter structure? That will allow you to find the right shoes. Every company makes shoes in different lasts, and that's their trademark. If you can find that, then you can find a shoe that will be more comfortable. If you find that, you'll find a shoe that will fit the orthotics that you have. If you find the right orthotics, you won't have blisters. If you won't have blisters, you won't have ulcers. If you won't have ulcers, you won't transfer the forces to the ankle joint. You won't have arthritis. Some brochures can help you. You can cross this off and find out, and this is an online version of it, and helps you in assess what kind of foot type you have, and you can take that to the store. Shoes can be made of nylon and leather. The height of the heel is important because some shoes are a little higher than others. Keep in mind the average is 1.5 inches. As far as shoe criteria, these are the ones that I would consider: stability, durability, availability, price and cost ratio, quality control, orthotic compatibility. And if you notice, I didn't say brand or make. Nothing to do with it. The surface where you run is very important. That will dictate how much shock absorption you have. There's clearly going to be a difference between running in the track versus on concrete. So pick your surface wisely. Those who are the athletes here know that stretching and warm-ups are very important. This is an important part for the overall well-being. Some people choose shoes from previous experiences, current needs, biomechanical needs, or environmental factors. All these are in consideration for shoes. But when I select shoes, I look at the following. What kind of sports am I going to be doing? You can't use a volleyball shoe for a marathon. Selecting the appropriate socks that will fit you best. Selecting the appropriate orthotic. Specialty shoe store, because the salesman can help you narrow down from 500 shoe types. Shop at the end of the day. Your foot might be largest at that time. Measure your foot wisely. Have a nice combination of socks and orthotics. And you should have about that much, 3/8 to half an inch between the front of the shoe to the first area where you have your toe or your skin contact to the area. Check your shoes regularly for defects and check for balance. Make sure the heel counters is stable. So if that first list of 10, you can't memorize them right away. If you can remember three things, these are the three. The heel counter must be strong, so make sure as you squeeze the heel, is very supportive. Make sure the midfoot doesn't twist very easily. And make sure the forefoot, meaning the toes, bend where your toes bend. Some shoes are designed to bend in the arch. You can have arch pain. Changing shoes is wise. Usually 350 to 550 miles is the most appropriate thing to do. I don't believe in having emotional attachments to shoes. Stay away from that. I have patients who bring me three bags of shoes, and literally I counted about 105 pairs of shoes at one time and trying to go over them, and only five qualify for good shoes. So I had to tell my patients to throw all the other shoes away. So be a wise shoe shopper. In summary, there are many conditions of foot and ankle. Hopefully I was able to review a few of them and give you hints as to what can lead to what. The mechanics are very important. As I mentioned, the lower extremities work like a pendulum. They need an equilibrium. They need to work side by side and in good proportion, range of motion, and angles. There are surgical options and non-surgical options as well, and I was able to illustrate some of this and to show you what some of these joints are: the ankle joint, subtalar joint, the mid-tarsal joint. Patient selection is very important. Not everything fits all. Just because there's one procedure doesn't mean that can apply to every patient. Hopefully I was able to give you some updates on biotechnology, what we're doing for arthritis and for the ankle. Prevention is the key. You're able to delay any future treatments and be able to delay treatments that you may be rendered for end-stage condition and buy you at least more time before you consider alternatives. Thank you very much. Yes.
There was an article in This Week at UCSD 2-3 months back about total ankle replacement using collagen. Can you speak about that?
The question was the information about ankle arthritis and collagen repair. That's something that I do. It's something that we developed here to allow our patients to perhaps avoid an ankle fusion or a metal implant. Yes, ma'am. Oh, so the question has been, I have plantar fasciitis or something else, where can I go? You can certainly come and see us. You can come and see us here at UCSD, Department of Orthopedics, in the foot and ankle section. There are many specialties that will see foot and ankle conditions. It can be part of your family practitioner. It could be your sports medicine doctors. But certainly, if you need advice from a specialist, you can come see us directly. Yes, ma'am.
Is there an age limit when you can use the new procedure, having the pin on the outside?
The question has been, the new ankle procedure, what's the age limit? Well, it's a new procedure. We don't know what the limit can be. My youngest patient has been somewhere in the 30s, who obviously didn't want a fusion or a metal implant that will break down. And an older patient that I can recall was about 85.
And how long do you usually have to keep the pin together for the cartilage to rebuild or
The average so far has been anywhere from 4 to 6 weeks. And then these pins are temporary and they come off. And at the end, you'll have no metal inside your ankle. Yes, ma'am. As long as your lower extremities, the question was, what's the most ideal surface to run or have sports activities? Depends on your sports. If it's purely running, track, grass will be ideal, something that will have some give and shock absorption. Concrete usually has no give, so all the shock will go straight down to your foot. The other thing that you also have to keep in mind is it's going to be a marriage between how you run, how you stretch, how you warm up, what kind of shoes you're also using for that particular day, and what kind of socks you're using, as I was trying to go over. It's going to be a combination of things. You want to equip yourself with all these ideal tools to give you the best performance so that avoids arthritis, so it avoids all the shock that is transmitted through the ground. So the question was, I have arthritis and walking on sand has given me more symptoms. That's quite common. I hear a lot of the stories like that. Some people can swear that they don't have any symptoms walking on sand. The issue with sand is the amount of moisture and the amount of give you find on the packing of the sand. In some areas, you'll find it to be nice and firm. In some areas, you'll see that your foot will sink and it will change. That causes tilting of your legs as your leg stands on it. Remember, your legs will work as a pendulum. As long as they are functioning equally in the range of motion, you'll have a balanced condition. In some areas, in some sand surface, your foot can give or will be more depressed on one side than the other. That will lead to the tibia and the knee to be tilted irregularly, then causing torque, pinching, abnormal rotation about the knee. Some people feel it all the way up to the spine because of the rotation forces building up from the foot all the way up. Yes, ma'am. No.
Do you drive a car?
No.
No. Do you look at a person's gait? Do you still have to measure all those angles, or how do you do that?
Yes, we do gait evaluation. We see how they walk, especially if that plays a role in stability for the patient. Especially if the patient is interested in sports or walking as an exercise, perhaps we fit them with the right shoes or give them a guide, like I was trying to give you a little guide as to what's a good shoe, and we fit them into orthotics. We do a gait evaluation to see if that brought the patient to a normal stance, to a normal position. Yes, sir.
I had some really good orthotics done, sports orthotics, about 20 years ago. They're broken. Chances are, over 20 years, you would see changes in the foot so that you would start from scratch, or could you follow the old form?
So the question is, I had orthotics for 20 years or 20 years ago. Can I follow that up with another orthotic, or is my foot changing? Orthotics usually are dependent on the material. These materials, remember, they are purely material. They won't last forever. We clock them to last anywhere from a year to two. That's average. 20 years is a long time. You should throw those away, put them in the museum. Can't use those. It's better off that you get new orthotics and new molds. Professionals actually go through orthotics on a weekly, a monthly basis. Because of the amount of performance and activities that they do, they just break them down too quickly.
Last question. I developed a bunion, one foot, earlier in the year. Never had one. My mother has big toes that go like this. You said something along the line that early treatment is something that should be checked so it doesn't continue, or see if there's anatomical issues.
Bunions are mainly caused by muscle alignment and muscle imbalance and joint malalignment. When they come out of alignment, the joint will not move smoothly. That can lead to arthritis. Patients who are young, patients who are healthy, are the most ideal patients to have that corrected early on so that you don't develop further arthritic changes to that joint, and thus you won't have to have other treatments like fusion, an implant, so you can have an alignment correction early on and avoid all that. Yes? We have spurs all over the body. Sometimes you know of them, sometimes you don't know of them. Spurs can be caused by the excessive pulling of tissue on bone, or sometimes can be caused by injury to the area. There's a calcium buildup to the area. It's mainly that calcium buildup that causes the shape of the spur. But more importantly is to find out why, what caused it. That's the more important question. Some people have spurs and they have no symptoms whatsoever. Yes, ma'am.
Can you speak to neuroma? What is that? How does it develop? And what can you do about that?
Neuromas are nerve conditions. It's commonly a mass. It's a nerve mass that can grow pretty much anywhere in the body. It's very common in the foot. It's usually described as a Morton xeroma, as one of the first early doctors to describe it. You can have it between the web spaces of the toes. They can grow into the toes, and they'll have little branches. Patients can have it on both feet, and patients can also have it in multiple spaces between the toes. I had a patient 3 months ago who had six neuromas, and we took half of them, and they can cause a lot of pain. These are nerves that are found on the bottom of the foot, and sometimes you'll be walking on them, you'll be pinching those nerves, causing the pain. Most of the times, conservative treatment is tried first, just to see if they will help. But if they all fail, then the surgical treatment consists of taking that nerve out. The removal of the nerve is quite successful. There's about 5 to 10% recurrence because the nerve has a chance to regenerate. We have to look out for those. They could come back, but most of them don't. You're welcome. Last question. We don't know. Usually it's not supposed to. Some people think it's the bursting of the bubbles and you are shifting the joint from one end to the other. It all depends on how much cartilage damage you're doing to the area. Do we advise it? Do we know more to tell you not to do it? Probably if it hurts, you shouldn't do it. Thank you very much.
This has been a UC San Diego Blinkcast. For more, visit us online at blinkcast.ucsd.edu.